Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mian Team.
With guest co-hosts.
Bats Maru.
James Robertson.
Silo.
Wow, you dream about Civ? You're alone there. Yes, I've never heard of something so crazy.
I'm backing away from the microphone now.
Uh-oh, I think I might be one of the crazy ones. Hi, this is Bats Maru. This is Polycast episode 79. Today we're going to be with Dan Q.
The guests are taking over the show.
James.
Hi.
And Salud.
And hi. There's something stupid for you.
In the news, Civilization IV Beyond the Sword released for the Macintosh, and coming soon, Civilization IV Colonization.
In Forum Talked, we discussed, should unique buildings remain on capture, culture flipping, and my issue with Keshix.
You have an issue with Keshix too? Why didn't you bring it up during when we were talking? Oh.
Somebody else's issue with Keshix.
In the research lab, we discussed units being linked specifically to civics, and return to Civ 5, a whole new Civ.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Civ Beyond the Sword, obviously, I've been playing that using Parallels on my Mac for quite a while. Didn't really have any idea this game was even coming out. I was at the Apple Store trying to get something fixed when my daughter pointed the game out to me, so I was real excited to see it. The cool thing is that now I can play this right on my Mac and not have to worry about bringing up Parallels and get all that crap that comes along with that. But, I mean, in general, I'm just happy to see it on the Mac because it's one less reason I ever have to boot Parallels up.
So you would recommend to people who have been playing Beyond the Sword through Parallels to go out and get this port? You've finally experienced that much better already.
Well, it doesn't crash. I've been involved in some multiplayer games with you where I disappeared off the grid. And the way it would happen is that you'd go into the diplomacy screen, or the diplomacy screen would be just about to come up and you'd see the leader's face. And it was when the leader's face was trying to render on the screen that we'd go bang, get a graphics error from Windows. Didn't happen all the time. It was playable, but it got irritating, especially in multiplayer games, and that just doesn't happen now.
Wasn't there another way other than Parallels to play Beyond the Sword Windows on your Mac?
Yeah, there's Boot Camp. You can boot the machine straight into Windows, and then you wouldn't have had those problems at all, because you'd be running Windows natively on the hardware. I was always too lazy to do that.
From a completely Windows user perspective, I thought, that's nice that Beyond the Sword came out for the Mac, but Beyond the Sword came out more than 2 years ago. That's going to be a little late. Either Mac players are going to still be playing Beyond the Sword, and they've gotten used to whatever minor quirks there might happen to be with how they have to play it. Either that, or they didn't get Beyond the Sword at all, and now they're not interested in Beyond the Sword, or they've moved on to another game entirely.
Well, you know, I don't know. I find it interesting that, like, a year and a half ago, there was a post in the forums. I'm not going to pull it up now, but I remember it was pretty authoritative about saying, there will not be Beyond the Sword for Mac, period, end of discussion. I mean, it was very, very final. And then, like I said, I wasn't even looking for it, and it just happened to pop up in front of me at the Apple stores. Somewhere along the line, the people at Take-Two decided that the Mac market had gotten large enough that maybe that didn't make sense anymore.
I expected the response from the Mac community to be, thanks. I know that would have been nice a couple of years ago, but it's a little late. But hey, got the Beyond the Sword 3.19 patch out of nowhere.
I have a couple other friends who are using Macs, and I think they're all pretty interested in it, too. It's just, I went out and bought it for Windows so I could run it under Parallels, but a bunch of people I know never bothered. They just said, fine, I'll just stay on Warlords, and I think there are some incremental sales that are coming out of that. It's a game with legs. A lot of games you buy for the game consoles or even for Windows are games you play for 6, 8, 12 hours, if you count continuous gameplay, until you finish it, and then you never look at the game again. Civ isn't like that. You play it for years.
I'll take your word for it, James. And so then Civilization IV, yes, Colonization is also coming a little over a year ago that it came out, so it's coming to the Mac natively a little sooner than it took Beyond the Sword. So as you said, maybe it is a better sign, a positive sign, that the Mac community is being given more credence and then the companies are able to see bigger dollar signs and decide that it's worth the effort to port it over.
Well, I think what a lot of people paid attention to is there was a report that came out a month ago that of all the sales of computers that are $1,000 and up, 90% of those are Macs. So basically, anybody who's spending real money on a computer is buying a Mac. And I think some companies have decided that if somebody's willing to spend real money on a computer, they're probably willing to spend real money on a game.
Well, a lot of that has to be with the dropping PC prices, though, because I picked up my computer for $500, and it's pretty decent, so I don't know.
I'm not saying that the PCs are worse. What I'm saying is that of the people that are spending $1,000 and up, 90% of them are buying Macs. And just in terms of sheer market penetration thing, if you've got a guy who's willing to spend $1,000 or $1,500 on a computer, if he's playing games, he's probably willing to drop $50 on a game, right?
That 90% and, you know, over $1,000, was that a report for the United States specifically or North America? Or?
I think that was North America. That certainly wasn't the rest of the world. I think the numbers for the rest of the world are going to skew down towards the lower end. Once you get out of North America and Europe, the numbers skew down a lot, I think.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
Unique buildings should remain our capture or not. We all know that the way they work now is that all buildings are converted to your unique building when you capture a city, but that might not be the best way. I, for one, think that the nice way to do that would be giving the bonus is the culture behind it, so it could be related to the culture and not the actual civilization who's currently occupying the city.
See, I've been kind of against the idea myself, but I was thinking it would be a good option to have, like, on custom games. But I do like the idea of having it tied to culture. If you still have over 50% of the culture of the civilization you captured, it stays there building and then switches over. But that might be a little complicated.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well.
There's already a ton of things to manage in the game. I'm just thinking if every city you capture ends up having one or two unique buildings as you move along through the map, think about what happens then if you capture a city and you have a unique building from one culture, and then somebody else takes it, they build a building, and then you take it back, and now you have two unique buildings from two different cultures. I mean, the complexity here just gets out of hand pretty quick, I think.
Well, what I thought was that there should always be at maximum one unique building, and that should be the culture that's most dominating in the city. I mean, if it's like over 50% Aztec, then should the sacrificial altar should stay there because it's related to the culture. But as time goes by and the Aztecs don't have the dominant culture anymore, then it converts to a normal courthouse.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, basically just for pure play balance reasons, that just gives an added advantage to someone who's taking the conquest route to winning the game, you know, and already, you know, you start getting really powerful once you start taking over a few of your neighbors, and this would just accentuate that in that you would have the added production, added money and all that, but you would also have access to new abilities and stuff that you did not have before, so it makes the steamroller effect kind of speed up, which I don't think is necessarily a good thing.
Well, it would steamroll even more if you had a culture flip where you get the city intact without any damage to it at all.
If you allowed to capture unique buildings, that would make civilizations whose unique buildings do not produce culture more valuable for conquest than ones that did produce culture, because you're going to lose their building when you take them over, while some civilizations have unique buildings that don't produce culture and therefore wouldn't be destroyed.
If you capture a city and the culture is still, as was being said, 50% more of the civilization that you just captured it from, then still have that unique building in there, but then you're going to have X number of turns of revolt where you're not going to be able to make use of that anyway. And you could end up with an interesting situation where I don't want my culture to become so great that it is actually a percentage that's more than whatever the civilization that you just captured it from. So if you're the Americans and you capture the Zulu city, and they also happen to have a little bit of culture from, say, Babylon, then as long as the Zulu percentage remains the highest, then you make use of that unique building, if they actually built that unique building in there. And so then you could end up with a situation where, you know what, I don't want to put a lot of my own culture into this city because I want to continue to be able to use the Iconda, which is the unique building for the Zulu, which replaces the barracks. But eventually, over time, regardless of what you do, your culture is going to increase incrementally because the city is going to grow, presumably. Or you could decide, I don't want the city to grow, so I don't want my culture to increase. And then you have the trade-off between, do I want to keep using that unique building and not have my culture become that great? Which then could also increase the chances of it flipping back.
Yeah, I don't think it would like lead to steamrolling. I mean, if you are Shaka and conquering Darius of Persia or something, then you want those Ikandas in the new cities, and then we'd probably just piss you off that you have some useless apothecaries in the newly captured cities instead of your great Ikandas.
You end up with a narrow window of opportunity, most likely in order to be able to use that unique building, a combination of your culture increasing in that city and the fact that you're going to have X number of turns of revolt after you capture that city where you're not going to be able to build anything anyway.
I don't know, even in real history, think about what happened when the Spanish took over Mexico. They demolished all the unique Aztec buildings and rebuilt churches on them. So even in real world history, this isn't all that common.
No, that's true. And perhaps wonder, what if that actually hadn't been happening? What if those buildings had not been destroyed? What if they'd made use of them?
And sacrifice some conquistadors.
I think you'd increase the likelihood of revolt, because the idea here is that if the local culture remains strong enough, then you're trying to conquer your neighbor and you're keeping that culture strong to be able to use that unique building. Don't you run the risk of having it stay in constant revolt?
Well, you have a situation kind of like that in Spain and also in Greece and stuff. You have a lot of churches and cathedrals that used to be mosques and vice versa. And so far, it didn't seem to be that big of an issue for them. That in and of itself, I don't think you would increase the revolt by allowing the locals to maintain their old cultural buildings as long as there was some kind of official, you know, this is now our culture building. But again, that's, again, dragging realism into gameplay.
Well, I'm talking about if you allowed those buildings in civ terms, if you left those buildings as the unique buildings of that culture, then that culture is remaining somewhat stronger. And if it's a border city, which would especially be true during a war, then you run the risk of having constant revolt in that border city as the opposing culture tries to take it back.
And I guess that ties even to a little bit into our next topic about culture flipping, which is where if you're in that situation, however it's measured, if you leave enough units in that city, if you were feeling strongly enough that this culture flipping is back is going to be a problem, or the revolt is going to continue or come back, then is the advantage of being able to use that unique building more than whatever effort I have to put into having a sufficient garrison in that city? You think, well, I'm not going to be able to use these units now continuing the battle because I would rather keep the city I've got and be able to use that unique building rather than going out and taking more cities. And I would think most of the time you wouldn't want to do that, but it could give you that option. And there may be situations where that's what you wanted to do, or at least try it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to be like another option that the AI is not going to be able to handle as well, another advantage that the player has over the AI, because I don't think it's going to be coded to know, hey, that it would be better to not build culture in this area and you make use of this building, while in other cases it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I think that's possible, and I guess it would have to come down to even the degrees in terms of just how much they are unable to make use of the advantage. Like, when I consider how well the AI handles naval warfare in Beyond the Sword as compared to Vanilla Civ 4, wow.
Yeah, maybe something for Civ 5, which I see is another topic. You know, keeping a big occupying force and then gifting great artists to your enemy so that they can keep their culture strong in your area.
What would be even more fun than those unique buildings would be if you could produce those unique units in a city that still has dominant culture other than your own. But that would be way overpowered, I think, much more than the unique building.
I think that came up in the thread, and if you want to look into real-world history, people have tried that, to have cultural units fight with their side as allies. But I don't know, that gets fairly complicated pretty quick, too, I think.
Yeah, the unique units thing is an extension of that consideration of the unique buildings. Ben H2E71 said, if Monty or Shaka were to conquer Gandhi, for instance, then you'd have a psycho warmonger with fast workers to contend with. I don't even want to think about Shaka with Praetorians.
It would make the units with the stronger civs kind of a bigger target for a lot of players because they'd want to get their unit. Instead of, let's leave Rome alone, it's be like, let's take them out first so we can get their Praetorians.
But you leave Rome alone?
I just restart whenever I see them.
Oh.
Just kidding.
Do you want to talk about the culture flipping thing since we kind of sort of covered that already?
Yeah, we kind of did sort of cover that already. Although in this situation, Species 5618 talks about being Civ 1 and now with Civ 4 and comparing it to Civilization Revolution And let's just say up front, I'm going to set aside that Civ 4 versus Civ Rev comparison because they're both fruit, but they're apples and oranges. That may not be the best analogy in the world, but...
they're different games.
And they sure are.
I was just saying, when I saw it discussed on the forums, also the culture flipping seems just a lot harder in Beyond the Sword than in Vanilla, and I've noticed that as well. It seems the AI defends against it much better.
Yeah.
Well, the AI is just better in general in Beyond the Sword than Vanilla Civ. If you pull up Vanilla Civ after having played Beyond the Sword for a while, it feels like you can move two difficulties up in Vanilla Civ and still play.
I actually moved two down when I started playing Beyond the Sword because I was like, okay, well, I'll move back to Noble, and then I got my butt kicked, and I said, okay, I'll try Warlord, and then I really struggled, and now I'm getting back up to Prince. But,
I had a nice moment yesterday where I flipped a city in 700 BC on Immortal. That was kind of a WTF moment.
Was that a result of a great artist culture bomb, or that in combination with some other things?
No, just creative plus library, and enemy never beat any culture there, so it just flipped right when I expanded two sets of borders.
Oh, I was about to say, did you have your city there first, and then they settled kind of ridiculously close to you?
No, actually, about the same time, but he just never built anything there.
The AI doesn't seem to care about future culture flips when it's deciding where to place your city sometimes. I've seen some pretty crazy ones. It's like, why did you put a city there? I'm like, I'll find it. You just, so-and-so city just joined your culture. I'm like, where could that be? And it's like, oh, it's up in my tundra to the north. And I didn't even know they'd build a city there because I never look up there.
The AI will build a city in any open spot, I swear. There have been times I've not bothered settling in the tundra because I didn't think it was worth it. And some stupid culture will have sailed a ship across the ocean and put one there.
Well, it's even nicer when they settle that spot right next to your capital and you're like, yeah, I'll flip that in a few hundred years. And then in a few hundred years, you notice that they are, like, taking tiles from your capital's BFC.
I see. For me, that find that would take a little too long. I just go in and raise the stupid thing with some armies.
Yeah, but the thing is, you, like, ignore it because you think that your culture would take care of you anyway. And then it's too late.
Right, that's figuring that you maybe don't want to launch a war on that civilization at this point in time, so you hope that your culture will flip it, and it just seems to take forever to do that, even if you throw culture bombs at it.
Yeah, another thing is flipping barbarian cities. Countless times I've settled 3 tiles away from a barbarian city. I don't bother building a couple of swords to capture that. I'll just flip it, and then when it's like 3 turns away from flipping, AI comes and conquers it, and rushes a damn theater in there.
I haven't seen a lot of culture flipping, not of cities in a long time, of tiles, yes. That's what I think of more when I think of culture flipping, are particular tiles. Oh, the AI has settled spot X, and oh, they're going to end up with that iron resource, and they don't have any iron otherwise. Why don't I just settle even closer to the iron if I can, and then, if not prevent them from getting the iron, at least delay them? That's all that city serves the purpose for.
Yeah, what I've seen with that is that you need to be very careful about maintaining decent diplomatic relations with the AI in that situation, because just settling that close to another city will often generate a war unless you have made a very strong effort to not have bad relations.
Some civs in particular, they dislike that close borders more than others.
Catherine likes the close borders. She likes to get closer.
Now it's turning into a whole different podcast again.
Something I do a lot, I don't know if it's really considered wise or not, is if I have a great engineer, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be getting some more of them because of what I'm building, using it to create a wonder in one of my border cities to kind of provide a constant culture push. Is that too risky, or something that you would only do when you're playing Noble or Prince, or what?
If you can get hold of those GEs, that's one of the best uses for them, I think. Eventually, both your city and the AI city are going to have the same standard theaters and monasteries there, and like extra push on top of that might be a critical.
Yeah, so long as you're able to defend that city so that the AI doesn't come in and take it. Thank you for building the wonder for me.
Yeah, but even helps in that. If you flip like one extra ring around your city and then they declare war, you have like one extra turn to react because they take one extra turn to reach the city.
Four 7 has an issue with Keshix. Historically, they seem more like knights to me. They fought around the time period of Genghis Khan, the 12th century, and against medieval-style opponents. I think it would be more accurate and cooler if Keshiks were a knight replacement, as opposed to a horse archer replacement like they are now. With 10 strength and a first strike chance at ignoring terrain movement costs, basically they're upgrades from horse archers, but on knights instead.
It's not even historically accurate, never mind game accurate.
We already have a couple of unique units that replace the knight. The fact that Keshiks are around when they are replacing the horse archer makes them more valuable. They're available earlier on.
And Keshiks, they don't require iron, do they? Because they really shouldn't if you're trying to be historically accurate.
The Mongolian Horde War was never a heavily armored unit. Their whole thing was that they were fast and lived off the land. So, you know, the whole thing is high mobility, highly accurate with the bow and arrow. But they weren't heavily armored. I mean, that's just not the way those units worked.
Another big advantage they had was that they had really advanced signaling techniques that hadn't been developed yet by the armies they were fighting back in that day. Basically, a general or whatever could command as many troops as could, you know, hear his voice. From very early on, the Mongolians were using flag signals and stuff like that to coordinate movements of large numbers of horse archers over a very wide distance, which really helped them.
Yeah, they invented cavalry warfare for the most part.
Yeah, I think the horse archer is the perfect unit for the Keshik to be. I mean, when you think of Mongols, you think of like vast hordes of horsemen terrorizing huge areas and cities. And if it was a knight, then you'd have all sorts of pikes and castles ruining your day. And even the two move is better before engineering, because after that it's easier to catch up to you. So I think it's perfect as a horse archer.
Frozak, in response to this thread, modified the game to make them replace knights with 10 strength, a 20% withdrawal chance, and start with drill 1, so you know, a plus 1 first strike chance. So I
then you'd never build anything else.
Drills 2 to 4 available to cavalry. It's like, wow. If you want to mod your game, to that level you can do that, but in standard Civ is about having a diverse army of units with their own strengths and weaknesses, and that would just roll over.
In the early game, you have the Axeman Rush, which often works if you get to copper first, but this would be in that early mid part of the game if you put that mod in. You'd never do anything but a Keshik Rush.
Yeah, well, that mod is a bit weird because it's like a camel archer, but better. But I can see like a good mod being there somewhere. Just can't figure out what it could be. I still like them better as horse archers anyway.
Parv is trying to expand the window you can use them in. That would be an interesting idea, but currently the way the game mechanics work is unique units. You know, a lot of times you kind of don't want to upgrade them to something newer because you lose so many of their great traits. If there was some way that unique units carried over at least one of their good things over into their future version, so you could like have knights with that train cost movement ignoring or something like that.
Well, even in real-world history, these kinds of units lasted right up until the firearms age. Knights were not the downfall of horse archers. Horse archers had higher mobility, so they were able to work around knights, and there were always higher numbers of them. What did them in was firearms, not anything else.
If there was some way to further limit the movement of knights compared to the horse archers, it might expand the lifespan of horse archers, maybe give them an extra movement point over the knights or something.
Yeah, that might make sense. You might take the Keshik and give it higher movement or something to give it more of an advantage over knights and horse archers.
Actually, Prozac said, at first I gave Keshiks 3 movement points, but this made them ludicrously powerful.
There's a shocker.
I think their ability to ignore terrain movement is just fine, but I'd like if units that were upgraded from Keshiks kept that, and that would make the Mongols powerful right up until when you use cavalry.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that they don't have the mobility upgrade like Impi do, and they retain that when they upgrade. Too bad it's useless, because all the things they can upgrade to only have one move.
Maybe if it was a promotion instead of just an innate ability, that way if they had some kind of promotion that did the same thing,
yeah,
that would be nice.
That could make them too powerful, though. Can be a balance issue if you make lasting bonuses on top of a very powerful unit to begin with.
Yeah, it would make early units even more powerful than they are now.
Yeah, because some unique units do that, like Berserkers retain Amphibious and Median Cavalry retain Flanking 1 and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's one thing I think Civilization Revolutions has a good idea on, is having multiple unique units for certain civilizations. That way you can have England have its longbows and its red coat. You could have a more primitive Keshik and a more modern Keshik.
I don't know, maybe higher movement, but only on certain kinds of terrain might make sense, because their big advantage was, in historical terms, when they were fighting over the steppes and more or less flat areas. The reason they got stopped in Europe was because they ran into hills.
Yeah, that's one of the things that instead of having an extra movement point, they ignore terrain costs, which kind of ignores that. Kind of flies in the face of that. You know, it's a, they're basically a horse archer that isn't slowed down by hills or forests.
Right, I would have maybe given them an extra movement point, but maybe penalized them a little bit for hills or just not given them any advantage over hills.
Right, or some kind of higher withdrawal chance on flat land or something like that.
Yeah, but you know, that again gets into that whole realism versus gameplay thing, and maybe the way those units are set now is just simpler.
Right, allows you to do a quick strike even to civilizations that are far away from yours. That's a big limiting factor on your two-speed units, is that most of the map doesn't allow you to move at your full movement rate.
Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. Units linked to civics. White Laughter has said that in real world, if a nation was building chariots or knights or even armored cars, it was pretty much running hereditary rule and arguably vassalage, with society funneling resources to a small military elite. However, to have hoplites or Swiss pike or the French Revolutionary Army, for any form of citizen army, there was some variant of republic. What do people think of having units linked to governmental styles, perhaps appropriate units getting a hammer bonus to being produced under their chosen government? Honestly, I think that what we have right now with civics is in good balance. Maybe there's some tweaks here and there, but having so that units are linked to the civics, to me, maybe there's a realism argument in there, but gameplay-wise, I really don't even see the advantage of trying to playtest that.
Well, there's a lot of people saying there's certain civics like police state and others that are hardly ever used, and this might be something that could be used to balance out the usefulness of the civics, you know?
Yeah.
Serfdom gave you some really awesome benefits on certain powerful units, and people might use it more, and likewise police state.
Yeah, if they would do that, then they would have to balance it out. Like, it would be really, really hard to balance it out, so it would end up being well done, because there's so many things to consider.
Well, then what happens if you change civics out of it? Do those units demote automatically to something? I mean, say you were playing police state, and that means, just to go completely out into the non-PC wing here, you're building what amounts to SS units. What happens when you decide, well, I'm not police state anymore, I've switched over to Republic? What happens to those units?
Yeah, that's one of the, those things they would have to like balance. Is it that you can only build them in a certain civic, or is it like static bonus when you have a certain civic? A lot of possibilities there, but a lot of possibilities means it's a lot of potential to screw up.
Cost of build reduction, perhaps even maintenance, you know, make it so that you don't have to pay maintenance on certain types of units if you're running a certain civic. So if you're doing serfdom, you can build up a big army of knights and not have to worry about it. But then if you switch to something else, then you're going to have to start paying more upkeep on them because you don't have your nobles providing the pay for their knights.
So if you had a huge army like that and you were making the benefit of that civic, why would you switch to another civic?
Well, the other civic may have some benefit. Like, you might need to go to slavery to rush some things and risk either paying higher maintenance or having to disband some of your army. You know, you may need a research advantage, so you change to Republic even though it's going to make your assess units cost more or something like that.
See, they're getting into specific units, not even unit types, but actually specific units. Whereas now, for instance, police state, government, civic, you have plus 25% military unit production, along with the minus 50% war. Or in vassalage, under the legal civic, new units receive plus 2 experience points. And there's no qualification of this particular unit, whether you're talking units by name, or you're talking units by civilization, or talking by branch, like mounted units, for instance. That just seems to me that what we're talking about here is just getting unnecessarily complicated. If it could be balanced, then trying to keep all of that in your head, need a spreadsheet or something.
Unit types might be a good way to work it then, because then you could just have mounted units get a maintenance bonus or a production bonus under certain civs, gunpowder units under another, etc.
See, this is an argument for justifying that second monitor you want to buy to your spouse, is that I need the second monitor so I can keep a spreadsheet up during my game playing of Civ.
Yeah, I think the biggest benefit you would get out of that is to balance out some of the less used civics like serfdom and police states. They tried to do a bit of that with the random events in BTS. I mean, the police state event is totally nuts, but it's not enough to usually use it. You can get an event which gives you a march on every current and future gunpowder units, and that's pretty damn insane when you're, like, fighting a conquering war.
I might have to use it now.
Well, certainly the argument for having it so that some of these civics are more likely going to be used is a good one. You mentioned the random events, and of course some people don't even play with those on, so then they would never see that. So while I think there should be something that we can do to make, say, police state more attractive, what's being suggested here, it's just leaving a bad taste in my mouth, to be honest with you. But taking with that, let's say that we actually did go with that. Vassalage, for example, new units receive +2 experience points. If you switch out of vassalage, then the units that you build after that are no longer receiving that bonus, whereas the units that you did build that under, they're not taken away. So I wouldn't want to see a situation where, oh, you built all these units in police state, now you're not in police state, now you lose that ability.
That's one of the pros, I believe, to the idea of just making a reduce in build cost and maintenance, because that way you can take it away. It's like, okay, you left vassalage, now you're going to have to pay normal cost to build these, and this huge army you built is going to cost you more now because you're not in that civic anymore.
In a nutshell, I think it would be, like, too complicated, like, for newcomers, and, oh, what's this new civic? It has +2 experience for that, and 3 units, and then plus production for this and that unit, and then they just stop reading, because they're so confused.
There's already so much to keep track of in terms of maintaining cities and your units that this is just one one more thing to forget, yeah.
I think if you just had one class of unit per civic and not for every civic, I think that would probably be manageable. Well, like, for instance, police state, you know, you get things there, and then the third, you know, production bonus on gunpowder units. And, you know, for serfdom, you know, production bonus on mounted units or something like that. That would be simplified, and I think it would be manageable. But I guess I'm going to be the dissenting opinion here.
Yeah, another way around doing that would be to, like, give unique units certain bonuses for using their favorite civic of a civilization, because now there's no incentive to use the favorite civic of the leader you are playing. So if your unique units would get a bonus from that, it could be a bit more dynamic.
Well, this thread has a poll attached to it. It's just got 10 votes right now. 4 people saying, yes, this sounds great. Might be worthwhile for a module, says 3, and then no, this idea sucks at 3.
No option for something like this, but a little different.
Yeah, might be worthwhile for a module.
That's what I'm going to vote for right now. There.
Nobody's voted for this third of 4 options, which is...
No, mad. I just voted for that one just now.
What, meh wouldn't add much, but wouldn't detract?
I just like the word meh, so I voted for it.
Return to Civilization 5, a whole new Civ.
Isn't Civ 4 kind of already a whole new Civ relative to Civ 2 and Civ 3?
Since 2, all of them have brought really a lot of new features and gameplay. Even though Civ 2 is kind of a lot more complex than Civ 1, really, it's probably the one that has the least difference from its earliest version, in my opinion. It added more units, but it didn't really change too much how the game was played from Civilization 1. Civ 3, it introduced culture, it introduced new government types, and it introduced strategic resources, all things which were completely new. That was actually probably the one that was the biggest change from the former version. Although, now that we got Beyond the Sword, I would say Civ 4 Beyond the Sword is maybe more different from Civ 3 than Civ 3 was from Civ 2, but vanilla Civ 4 was probably closer to Civ 3 than Civ 3 was to Civ 2.
What I'd like, as of now, expect from Civ 5 is to take all the new stuff added in BTS, like espionage system and better AI, and make those even better. It wasn't designed from ground up to include those features.
We'd like to see more interplay between espionage and just the core gameplay. Yeah, espionage is something that tends to be glossed over in a lot of games.
Yeah, I almost never use espionage in my games, but I would think that if the game was designed from ground up to include it, it would be a lot more fun and more core part of the game than it's now.
The other thing is, it was added that I think could be integrated better is corporations. I mean, they work really well with the game, but they're such a late game thing that a lot of times you never get to them. And in reality, they might not be called corporations, but you had trading routes and trading companies and stuff earlier in history. And it'd be nice to see some kind of equivalent, a spreadable business thing that could provide benefits to your society. Emulate how important the people and the Silk Road and all that was to building up civilization. It was more than just you had more resources.
Yeah, the problem with corporations now is they come so late in the game that you're concentrating either on getting that last bit of the world conquered, to get to the victory condition that way, or you're busy building the spaceship. They almost never take a major part in the game at this point.
Yeah, I think that's another example. If they were included in vanilla, then they would have designed the game to include them. They couldn't just, at Silk Road Corporation, like, make people build Silk Road executives now, but if it was designed from ground up to include something like that, it could be a more basic part of the game.
I think it's maybe a case of where they kind of put too much emphasis on realism. They said, okay, we're going to call them corporations, and like, okay, well, where do corporations start getting big? Should have had like a little bit broader mind. Maybe we shouldn't call them corporations and make it something we can add earlier in the game.
It's a good idea that was just added to the game at a point where, like I said, they're not that useful because at the point they come in, you're probably engaged in something else.
They can win you the game as they are now, but still, it's not that often it happens. And it's like, yeah, it's just a bonus on top of everything else more than an important aspect of the gameplay.
Yeah, probably the biggest impact I've seen from them is I've had other players switch to state property just to avoid my corporations.
That's annoying when you finally get all your corporations and you check that screen and everybody's either running state property or mercantilism and you're like, oh, great.
At least you can trade for all the resources then. Using your own corporations if you just want the bonuses and not the cash.
Yeah, that can get really overpowered at times, especially if you got a lot of people willing to sell their fish and rice and stuff. I like that you can use multiple of the same resource to get a benefit. That's something that I've always kind of thought was odd, that you have access to one fish, that's all you need for your whole empire. And then small corporations add something to give the benefit of, hey, let's get fish from multiple sources, and we'll get even a bigger benefit. And that might be something even to look at into Civ 5, making it so that resources stack in some way. Not in a way that overpowers or unbalances them, but that's something I like about corporations I'd like to see added to the whole game. What influence Civilization Revolutions is going to have on future versions, because it does add a few neat ideas that I'd like to see in a full Civ game, like getting a benefit for being the first to reach any tech and the era-specific bonuses and more things to differentiate the different leaders from each other. It's a different Civ game that should be an influence, I believe.
I do have Civilization Revolution on the DS, and my experience has been that the leaders are very much the same. What I like from Civilization Revolution, talked about it before on the show, but let's bring it all under this umbrella, the ability to capture great people. That, and also the ability that if you settle a great person, you can, in the future, decide to move them out of that city and settle him somewhere else.
Yeah, that seems like a really good idea.
There are other things about Civilization Revolution that I think would be good to have in potential Civ 5, but...
Roads?
Well, that's actually interesting how roads, or even the whole worker thing, is done in Civ Rev, where you don't have worker units.
Yeah, I don't want to lose the workers, but I think road building for workers is one of the most kind of boring uses of them, and I like the idea of having roads be something different from worker projects.
Where in Civ Rev you pay for the road.
Right.
Now, it does end up being a direct connection between one city and the other. You don't end up with the ability to, say, road all of the tiles necessarily around a Civ. Unless you had so many cities, which is possible in Civ Rev because there's no infinite city sprawl. Where if you had so many cities in Civ Rev, then some cities, they have so many roads sticking out of each other going in all directions to go to your other Civs. Maybe. So I wouldn't want it to be something exactly like in Civ Rev in that respect. And actually... on our fellow podcast, RevCast, some of the big multiplayer guys actually say roads are crap, and because you can build them instantly, and other units can use your roads as if they were their own, could be really devastating, because some people, like with the AI, wait for them to connect their cities by roads and then just go on a rampage.
Yeah, that seems like a kind of a poor design decision there, but I don't think they should take everything that's in Civilization Revolution and add it into the next one. There's some things that seem kind of gamey and questionable, like the relics. I wouldn't like to see something like that in a serious Civ game, except maybe as an option.
Well, relics to me, in a way, not to the same extent at all, but I kind of think of them as Civ Rev's quests. And I guess it's because of their infrequency. Quest is a one-time thing, and so is a relic. But the timing of the relic can be particularly impressive, because there's one, I'm even forgetting the name right now, where you get a whole bunch of technologies instantly. Definitely, I think, anybody who says that Civilization Revolution is not going to have an impact on what we see on Civilization 5 is deluding themselves. Now, whether that impact is good or bad, of course, that's another question altogether.
I think Sid just has like a notepad next to his bed and he just wakes up and, yeah, I'll tack this to the next Civ game. definitely going to see some of the new aspects from CVREV in C5 if and when it comes out.
I don't think we're going to see any major changes like it becoming a real-time strategy game or having Total War-style warfare in combat, although some of those ideas would be kind of neat and fun. The Civ series has been kind of conservative in that way. Certain things that are the same going all the way back to Civ 1. You know, I've seen a lot of people posting that they're expecting a combination of Civilization Revolution and Total War-style warfare. And
now, I'd actually say they now have two different games out, in a sense. Civ Revolutions is a short, fast-moving game, whereas Civ 4 Beyond the Sword is a long, involved, and relatively complex game. And I think you've got two different markets there. With Civ Revolution, catches a much more casual gamer audience than does Civ 4.
Oh, absolutely. But I do think that there are elements from Civ Rev that would be beneficial to have in a Civilization 5, particular elements. I wouldn't want to see Civ 5 be like Civ Rev, or vice versa for that matter. Because you are, as you said, you are targeting different segments of the gaming market.
Yeah, probably the main thing I'd worry about is if the classic decision that some companies seem to make, that the revenue pile looks bigger here than here. Oh, well, we don't need that complicated game. Let's just produce the simpler one.
Maybe if Civilization Revs 2 sells really, really well, that might be a thing to be afraid of. But I think at this point, they got four very solid, complex computer strategy games, and then they got one fairly successful console strategy game. I don't think we don't have to worry about that with Civ 5, maybe Civ 6, I don't know.
As long as they don't try to tack the same game to PCs and consoles like in some other genres these days.
Yeah, I was actually wishing the other day that they would do a port of Civ Rev for the PC just so I could give it a shot, because right now I'm considering buying a Nintendo DS just so I could play it. Because, you know, I've been reading up about it, and some of the ideas seem kind of neat, and it would be kind of a change of pace from what I'm normally playing.
I have it on my iPhone.
I think there's room for both in the market. If you have people like me who would like to have both games, then I think that they're going to continue to keep the two series split up.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Excuse me.
Want to introduce the new co-host, Jess?
Yeah!
She says she doesn't want to do that. She's three. She's not playing Civ yet. It's the 8-year-old who plays Civ.
Oh, yeah. I see. Wait, she's already three and she's not playing Civ yet? Come on, Dad, really?
Yeah, I usually start about the time they're able to read.
Are you reading that book again? Are you kidding me? There's a computer over there. You go play Civ.
Right.
Keep your priorities straight.
So, with that, we come to the end of the show. I know.
Thank you for listening to Polycast Episode 79. We're here with Dan Q.
The guests have taken over.
Silu.
Hi, still haven't figured out anything funny to say.
That's Maru.
I decline to comment.
He's taking the fifth there, I guess. And me, James Robertson.
Hi, this is Bats Maru. This is the let me start over on that.
All right, a blooper. Thank you.
We love bloopers. I'm not arguing that the Mac isn't picking up a lot of popularity. It obviously is. They're even starting to get some of their own viruses now. But
Fight truth on there. We're here with... Geez, I don't remember any of the nicknames, so... somebody else is going to have to do this then, because I've lost my brain.
my response was going to be completely inappropriate.
Oh, please do. This is what editing is for. Go for it.
Never mind.
Record date?
October 3rd, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009. Civilized Communication at civcom.net.